Christian Educational Ministries is pleased to present Ronald L. Dart.
I began to wonder recently about a phenomenon that seems to be perpetual in the church, always with us, like the poor somehow. Church politics is always there. And I sometimes have wondered if maybe we have confused along the way church government with church politics. If what we have assumed is church government really, as it turns out, is really nothing except church politics. Now, some of you may remember having heard somebody make the statement once upon a time that God's government is government from the top down. Now, that sounds quite reasonable. Who's going to govern from the bottom up in a government that God's at the top of it? Obviously, God is going to call the shots. God is going to give the direction. God is the supreme ruler. God's going to tell us which way we should go. But what the statement is saying is not merely that God is at the top and God is in charge, but that there is a hierarchy that exists, that a continuum, if you will, of individuals or people or structure that exists all the way from God down to the lowliest member of the Church of God scattered out in the hinterland or wherever that last scattered member might find himself. Now, really, it seems like a good idea in theory. Because truly, somebody has to be in charge. Somebody's got to call the shots. There's got to be some direction that takes place from somewhere. And a hierarchy where you have one person in charge up here, and he has about five people that report to him, and each of them have about five people that report to them, and each of those 25 have five people each that report to them, and it sort of branches out, theoretically, should give you a much better control, and it should be something that works pretty well. The first time we encounter this concept, I guess, historically, is a man named Jethro, who came to visit Moses, who was his son-in-law. And as he came and he sat and he spent some time with Moses, he noticed that from morning to evening, Moses was occupied from daylight to dark and apparently even beyond, sitting in one place where he really couldn't move about and really know much of what was going on anyway, judging the people. That there was only, he was the only one that was there. He was the only one that could judge. And so there was this line. It went down this way a ways, and then it turned off to the left around a couple of rocks and behind a ridge of people waiting, all lined up to see Moses. And you get the impression that some of them may have lined up before dark, or maybe have been there a couple of days, or somebody faints and falls out of line, we all ratchet one up so we can be a little closer to finally get up there to hear our case heard by Moses. And it was wearing him down. And Jethro looked at that, and common sense told Jethro, this is not going to work. And Jethro says, what you need to do then is that you should provide, verse 21, out of all the people, able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place over them, or such over them, to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. A simple, neat little pyramid. And he said, it shall be, let them judge the people at all seasons, and it shall be that every great matter they bring to you, every small matter they shall judge, and so it shall be easier for yourself, and they shall bear this work with you. Now, on the surface at least, you would think that a structure like this would greatly reduce a lot of the politicking, wouldn't you? You got somebody that's in charge. You have a clearly defined organizational structure with, what shall we call them, captains of thousands. There would be the persons, I guess, that were closest to Moses, and they were the top level of the hierarchy. Then you have the captains of hundreds right under them, and then the captains of tens right under them, and right under them are fifties, and then right on down, whatever it happens to be, all the way down to captains of fives or what have you. And if we had to, we'd go all the way down to captains of two. You know, we could really structure this thing out and make it a very manageable pyramid style of government, and there just wouldn't be any need for anybody to go politicking around. You would think that that tended to work. But anyone who has had any experience with a let's say with a hierarchical organization will know that it just isn't so. The truth is that the stronger, the more clearly defined is a hierarchy, the easier and more effective is political activity. Think about it for just a little bit. Now, it's true of whether the organization is an industrial giant like Bethlehem Steel or whether it's an obscure religious sect like the Church of God International, if we were set up that way, which we're not. The more clearly defined the seat of power, the more clearly focused is all political activity, right? I mean, if you'd really know with precision where the absolute final seat of power is in an organization, then you know precisely how you must orient all of your political activity to achieve the desired results. And so what it serves to do, a hierarchy, is to bring all that political activity into very sharp focus and increase its effectiveness many, many times over. Now, my own experience with hierarchies is limited. I've been involved in two hierarchical structure organizations in my life. One of them was the United States Navy. The other one was the Worldwide Church of God. The Navy attempted to exert really considerably less power over my life than the Worldwide Church of God did. Now, the Navy, in a very narrow spectrum, exercised considerable authority. They told me, essentially, where my duty station was and what time I had to be there. They told me what I had to wear at certain times in the way of uniform. I knew precisely what my grade was and my responsibilities were, and I knew I had to do them or else suffer punishment. And I knew that I had to follow all lawful orders. And that in itself was a very encouraging thing. Whenever I stood up as a sailor for the first time, held up my right hand and swore that I would obey all lawful orders. Somebody had taken the trouble to explain to me beforehand what that meant. That meant that no one over me in the Navy could abuse me. No one over in the Navy could command me to do something that was contrary to the law of the land or the rules of the Navy, the Articles of War, or anything else. In other words, the Navy was quite limited in its power to exercise authority over me in that way. Now, when we come to the Worldwide Church of God, we have Mr. Armstrong sitting back here in the back of the room. Now, you could go to him and you could ask him if he ever noticed any political activity in the Worldwide Church of God. However, now if you're going to go ask him that, I would suggest that you take your lunch and maybe your bedroll, because it is going to take a while for him to explain it to you and maybe list off some illustrations and tell you how it worked and all of the ramifications and all the things that went on in the organization as far as political activity. What would you say percentage of our time that we spent in political activities? Was it 90%? More? Less? Somewhere up there, you could 80%? Probably, really, we can look back on hindsight and say, oh, probably 90%, but I'm sure it wasn't quite that bad. You have to turn around and look at some of the creative work that we did and realizing that a considerable amount of our time was involved in creative work. So I would say probably political activity may not have gotten more than 60%. But that's horrible when you think about it. If as much as half of your time in an organization like that of top executives and creative people are trying to get on, you know, when Mr. Armstrong was in it in studio doing telecast, he was free from political activity then, wasn't he? Well, not exactly. Not exactly, because politics could even reach into the television studio and begin to attempt to influence what he was putting on the air. It could happen. It seems that nowhere, at no time, though, were you really just ever completely free. I came back off a trip, been overseas, been a long way around. No, I think I've not been overseas this time. I've been across the country doing some things. And one of the other executives on the fourth floor came into my office and plunked himself down in a chair and he said, I hear you've been saying some bad things about me. I'd like to fell off my chair because I considered the fellow a good friend. And I said, huh? What? Well, I understand that you have been against Quest magazine. I've been trying to do this. You've been against Quest. Well, now, you know, with hindsight, all of us really probably should have been against Quest as far as that's concerned. And I think I probably sat up in the sauna with sweat dripping off of me on the floor and cracked a joke or two about Quest magazine and wondered out loud whether we should have ever gotten involved in the first place, and so on. And I am reminded of a proverb that says, give not heed to every word that is spoken, lest you hear your servant curse you. That, you know, people have the latitude of disagreeing with certain policies and things you do without rejecting your own personal friendship. Well, I tried to reassure this fellow, and what had happened is that someone had told him that I had said certain things about him, which I hadn't said. But on the other hand, even if I had said them, why was this person going to tell him? Well, essentially what he was trying to do, because this person was in a pivotal position of influence, he was trying to diminish my influence with this person and to increase his own. The simplest and purest form, if purest a word, of political activity known to man. I want to diminish his influence, and I want to increase my own. Most of the time, when people come to you in any organization or structure or social grouping of people and tell you something negative about another person, and or say that somebody has told me something, you can bet that basically what's going on is the adjustment of influence, the magnification of somebody's influence at the price of someone else's. And all this is a jockeying for position, maneuvering around so that I can have an influence on the outcome greater than the other person's influence on the outcome. And it just goes on and on and on. It really can get to be a very discouraging and depressing state of affairs if you're in an organization where that sort of thing has gotten out of control. And it really can. Now, the hierarchy seems good, though, on the surface, and it seems good in the short term. And Moses certainly accepted Jethro's solution and implemented it, and it seemed to work. Actually, it seemed to work. But you see, the political activity that must have existed didn't go away. They were just like, you know, it's sort of like getting fleas in the carpet. You can kill off all the adults, but two or three weeks later, the eggs are going to hatch, and you got fleas in your carpet again. And this is basically the sort of thing that tends to happen. And so they made this adjustment, but the structure didn't change all of the ramifications and all the little odds and ends that were going along around the edges. Now, bear in mind also that the solution of creating the hierarchy, of structuring the pyramid that Jethro offered, was a strictly human solution. And it brought with it a whole new set of strictly human problems. Take your little Bible there and turn over with me to Numbers, the 11th chapter, and I'll show you where we went from there. Now, Numbers is just full of the continuing problems that Moses had during a period of time when he was operating with a hierarchical form of government. Jethro's ideas had been implemented. They were trying to get this thing all structured. They were percolating right along. But look at what happened here. In the 11th chapter of Moses, he's having a lot of trouble with the people. There are a lot of murmuring going on. In verse 10, Moses heard the people weep throughout their families, every man in the door of his tent. And the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly. Moses also was displeased. And Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people upon me? Have I conceived these people? Have I begotten them that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom like a nursing father buries a sucking child unto the land which you swore to their fathers'? When should I have flesh to give to all this people? They weep to me, saying, 'Give us flesh that we may eat.' I am not able to bear this people alone. It's too heavy for me." And indeed, I really honestly can understand how the man must have felt. "If you deal this way with me, kill me, I pray, out of hand. If I have found favor in your sight, don't let me see my wretchedness." Now, what is God's solution? We've seen Jethro's solution. We've seen the way Moses worked it out, that it could be worked that way. You can put together a pyramid structure. You can set up a hierarchy. You can get yourself captains of tens and captains of 50 and captains of 100 and captains of 1,000. But here is God's solution to a time when Moses is complaining about the burden, that he just doesn't want to carry it alone. God said, "Gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them to the tabernacle of the congregation that they can stand there with you. And I will come down and talk with you there. I will take of the Spirit which is upon you, and I will put it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you bear it not by yourself alone." Now, what is interesting about this is that God suggested no structure. He did not say anything about captains of 50s or captains of 1,000. In fact, there's a peculiarity of this that I hadn't noticed before. 70 doesn't divide by 12, which there were 12 tribes. There were 12 natural divisions of people out here. And when you get 70 elders, that doesn't divide by 12. The implication is that this didn't even structure out by tribes, but was something that was structured as a whole for the whole of the people at all times. This was not really an organization of a further organization or structuring of the power. What actually took place here was a diffusing of the power and of the responsibility and of the burden that was upon Moses. Because you see, you cannot diffuse or get out among other people the responsibility and the authority unless you send along with it a certain amount of power. And this is why God says, I will put some of your spirit upon all these people. I will grant to them a certain amount of power. And so what actually was happened here was a diffusion of power. Now, when this happened, what do you suppose happened to the overall level of political activity among the children of Israel at this time? Do you think the number of conferences between people who were pulling down somebody else while they built up themselves, of those who were trying to diminish the influence of this man and increase the influence of that person, do you suppose that the number of meetings between people diminished or went up when that took place? Chances are it didn't change. Chances are it didn't change at all. They probably kept right on meeting people and talking to people and jockeying for position. But it was dispersed and it had reduced effectiveness because of the fact it had lost its focus. You could not accomplish as much by getting a hold of one man because there might not have been that many of them. You had 70 or 69 other people to contend with. Even after you had influenced one of the men who were directly under Moses, there were still 69 other people out there rendering influence, and apparently not even limited by jurisdiction. For there is no hint in this of a jurisdiction for any of these 70 people. Now, you're going to take care of this area over here, and you're going to take care of this, and you're going to take care of the other. I would have, 144 of them would have divided out by 12, and you would have suspected that there were 12 for each tribe of Israel. And these 12 were over here, and this 12 over here. Don't mess with the work of that 12 over there. But there's not a hint of any of that. Not a hint of any of that. And so what happens seems to be a diffusion of power. And I wonder if this gives us some indication, some little hint right here, as to what actually took place at the power of Babel. When all the men of the earth were of one language and of one tongue, and they were all working together, and they were going to build this great tower up to heaven and make a great name for themselves, and were all united and had this complete creative focus of political activity, that God looked down upon that and said, that's not going to work. Divided their languages, divided their tongues, and divided people. And how we're told elsewhere, he has made of one blood all the people on the face of the heaven, and he has set before the boundaries of their habitations, in order to avoid that single focus of political power that could exist in that kind of a situation. It is a fascinating concept. Power was diffused when he took that step of dividing the tongues at the Tower of Babel. But come back to the church. Should politics, as such, exist in the church? Now, your first impulse is to say, well, no, there really shouldn't be any politics going on among the church and people who love one another. But the problem is when you attempt to answer the question by saying no, you have made it a valid question. And it really isn't a valid question, because, frankly, the question is nonsense. It's like asking, should God allow people in his church? Because if God decides he's going to allow people in the church, there will be politics in the church. There isn't any way of getting around that. So rather than us sitting around sort of saying, well, there just shouldn't be all this political activity going on in the church, instead of just sort of getting ourselves aggravated, or maybe judging other people or criticizing people, saying, there's something wrong with us, we're doing something wrong, we shouldn't have politics in the church, maybe we should just spend a little bit of that effort trying to understand church politics rather than out of hand just attempting to deny church politics. Now, if you'll turn with me over to 1 Corinthians, we're going to go to a really familiar scripture, one that we have used so many times you almost beat it to death, because it's the old classic example of division that arises in a local church. I've looked at this, and I remember somehow or other this year at the feast, I was coming home, and it just came into focus, the aggravation that exists over church politics. And maybe there's something I said to myself that we're not understanding just right. Maybe we haven't gotten the right angle on all this thing. Why is it that we have all of the politics that's going on in the church? Well, in 1 Corinthians 1, we have a simple, classic little division in the church, one of the earliest recorded in the Bible. Now I beseech you, brethren, 1 Corinthians 1:10. Now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and the same judgment. I suspect that if I had been Paul, I would have written something very much like that if I had heard from the Corinth. I would have been so chagrined by what was going on. I would have been so upset by the divisions, and I would have said, but that shouldn't exist in the church. That should not be happening there. And I would have done everything I could to try to straighten it out. Looking back now with 2,000 years of hindsight, I have to realize that, well, what he is asking for is beautiful. And it is absolutely wonderful that we would all speak the same thing and that there would be no divisions among us. And yet I have to be realistic and realize that as long as there are people, there this type of thing is very likely to exist. He went on to say, "It has been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that there are contentions among you. Now this I say, each one of you is saying, well, I am of Paul, or I am of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ." Paul is so frustrated, he says, "Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Maybe you were baptized in the name of Paul." Thank God I didn't baptize anybody there except a couple of people, or else somebody would be going around saying it was my church. He was quite annoyed with these people. The little annoyances crop out ever so often as you go through the letter with the sarcasm and the little digs that he makes against them, and I'm sure they felt like they could walk under a snake's belly by the time they got through reading this letter. I certainly feel I would have if I had been in Corinth at the time, because whatever else Paul was, he was a master of sarcasm and could cut you without you even realizing you'd been cut until you got home and started thinking about what the man had said. Now, what happened here, and I ask myself, what in the world is the benefit or even the meaning of saying, well, I am of Paul? Well, okay. Or another person saying, well, I am of Apollos. Oh, well, fine. So what's the big deal? You know, another one decides he'll put them all in their places. I'm of Christ. And I ask myself, okay, all right, yeah, what's going on here? But then all of a sudden I realize maybe what's going on is not nearly so important as why. And in trying to figure out, you know, how in the world a person could possibly expect to benefit, or what the meaning even could be of saying, I am of Apollos, who was a, you know, a man, very eloquent speaker, entertaining to listen to, very persuasive, powerful and effective, keep you awake, sitting out on the edge of your seat. Okay, you know, I enjoy listening to him. That's fine, it's wonderful, but why is it that I have to choose sides? Because that's really what people were doing. They were sort of choosing sides. Well, I'm of Apollos, who are you? Who are you with? And you found your identity, almost as it were, by saying, well, I'm of Cephas, or I'm of Paul, or the self-righteous one, perhaps, we think, says, well, I am of Christ. Why? Well, I think I begin to understand a little bit. Church politics grows out of a very human need. It isn't necessarily something that comes from malice or envy or just is naturally sinful right at the very root of the whole thing. It grows out of a very real human need. And after all, God made us the way we are, and there are needs that you and I have. And sometimes we corrupt those needs, and sometimes we use them well. The need in question here is one which I think is not very well understood by people, but it is very real, let me assure you. It is the need to impact. The need to impact. This is the need to believe that you yourself are capable of being a cause in the cause-effect sequence. Do you ever go through your life feeling you're on the effect end of it all the time? You know, I can't change anything. I can't make anything. Things happen to me, but I can't make anything happen. I seem to be in this rut. It goes up over my head on both sides. I can't get out of it, you know. I talk to people and people won't listen to me. I try to effect change and nothing takes place. Just feel blocked. Every time you turn around, you just can't effect anything. Well, human beings have a need to be a cause. They say, I exist. I am important. I can change things. I can cause and effect to take place. It is almost as though, psychiatrists or psychologists tell us, we need to prove that we are existing, that we exist, that we are not ghosts, as it were. Some of us sometimes may feel like this guy we see in the television commercial. You know, the guys in the white suits are coming to get him and walking through walls and leading him through walls, and he tries to talk to him, and they just act like he isn't even there. They don't hear him. They don't see him. And these fellows, you know, take him gently by the arm and up the heavenly escalator and say, well, you just don't understand. It's a good thing you had a piece of the rock. Your family are all taken care of, but your time has come to go with us. You're a ghost. You can't affect things. Now, you can prove you exist. You can get yourself a shovel. You can go out here and you can find yourself a spot somewhere and you can start digging. You can dig a hole in the ground. Dig one about, 3 feet around and go down about 3 feet and lay the dirt all around it. And you get out, take your shovel in your hand, stand on the side and look back at that hole, and you can say, I know I exist. I dug that hole. You know, there it is. I actually caused something to happen. I've actually taken the face of the planet and I've put a pimple on it. You know, I've changed it. I've actually made a hole out here in this thing. Or I can go out here and I can get myself some tubifores, you know, and some plywood. And I can hammer and nail and hammer and nail and saw and all this type of thing. And I can actually build a little structure. And I can back off and look at that. I must exist. I built that. I actually made that. Or I can go out and I can tear something down. And I can say, see, here's a before picture. Here's an after picture. I tore it down. I exist. I can make something happen somewhere along the way. Now, unless you think that that's not important, during the Korean War, the Chinese who came down across the line, the Koreans who took some American prisoners of war during that time, practiced a technique known as brainwashing. You may not realize that one of the most effective tools that was used in making brainwashing work was the denial of impact. In other words, the man was put in a very small cell. He was given very little to eat. He was deprived. He was uncomfortable. He was cold. And there was a guard in the cell out in the hallway outside. And he could talk to that guard. He could make requests of that guard. He could shout at him, scream at him, curse him, swear at him, anything he wanted to do. And the guard acted as though he was not even there. He did not even get a no. He didn't even get the guard to come over and punch him or hit him with a rifle butt. For had he been able to do that, he would at least been able to say, I am here. But he was left for the long periods of time with a complete denial of his ability to effect anything. He could not even make another human being acknowledge that he was existing. He was like a ghost in the house who would talk to the guard, yell at the guard, scream at the guard, and the guard just stared right off into space as though he were not even there. They allowed these men to have impact on, that is to communicate with, only one or two people for all they were able to communicate with. They were accused of a crime. They were told they must confess, and if they said anything other than the confession, they were not acknowledged as though they had even spoken. They could swear, they could curse, they could scream, and they were put back in their cell, and they were deprived of food, they were deprived of a blanket, they were just left there, and they were left, and they were left. And they were brought back and accused of the crime again. And the most serious part, the most effective part of this was the fact that the only way they could ever have impact was by capitulating and saying, I am guilty of the crime of which I have been committed, and they got a response. That's the only way they could get a response from their captors, was by giving in. And so the denial of impact on other people, on your environment, began to take away from these men, even to a certain degree, their awareness of themselves, their awareness of their own separate existence. And this is really also illustrated, I think, in the fact that most of us will choose a negative impact rather than having no impact at all. We would rather be hurt than ignored. One of the most fascinating things, this is many years ago, when I was visiting in a minister's home, and he and his wife had a new baby. And beautiful little thing, charming and just gurgly and pleasant and happy, and she was a good baby too, and good babies can be such a focus of attention. But they also had a little 3-year-old girl. And this little 3-year-old girl was being ignored, and she was slowly becoming a thing or a non-person in the household, like a ghost in the house, because she would speak and nobody would pay any attention to her. And they would gurgle over the baby and give attention to the baby and talk baby talk to the baby, and she would stand there by the baby, and if she reached out, her hand was pushed back. She wasn't allowed to hold the baby. And slowly this sort of an anger, I could see it so plain. I could not understand how the parents could not see it. And the child grew, you know, it began to provoke. And so what happened over the process of time, she got several spankings when I was there. And it became so obvious to me that it was embarrassing, and I don't know if I ever said anything to the father or not. I wanted to, desperately. The child would have rather have been spanked. She would have rather have been chastised, sworn at, shouted at, yelled at, slapped, or anything. She could not stand to be a ghost in a house. She couldn't stand to be ignored. She had to have impact on her father. It was so interesting. She would kind of try to crawl up in his lap, and he would be talking or carrying on a conversation, and she would say something, he would ignore her. And she would reach up, as children are apt to do, take hold of the face, and try to turn her father's face around. She had to have that focus. She had to say, "I'm here. I'm here. Please look at me. Please notice me. Please respond to me." I'm sure she's going to grow up to be a fine young lady, and I hope that temporary phase of jealousy and family problem worked out in the process of time. And I don't particularly criticize these parents for it, because I've seen it happen too many times with too many parents, and it's so hard to do, to give that kind of attention and the love and affection equally to both children. And a new child, new baby comes along, and the new baby can't understand why it must be patient and sit on the side, while someone else receives a little bit of attention. And you think the older child can, but really, I'm not sure the older child really has come to that place. But the child will prefer a painful experience to being ignored. In other words, a negative impact is better than no impact at all. Happens with a neglected spouse. A wife trying to talk to her husband, he's watching television, and she gets to the place to where she feels like a ghost in the house. She could be like this fellow in the commercial. She's talking to him, nothing happens. Talks to him some more, nothing happens. You read the newspaper, talk some more. It's as though she wasn't even there. And so why that happens? We get a huge big fight going, because a fight is better than nothing, right? I don't think any of you married couples have ever had a fight, have you, because you'd rather fight than be ignored? You bet you have. We all, none of us are willing to put up with the denial of impact. It can make you feel like a ghost in your own home. The frustration of this need can really lead to some pretty bizarre behavior. And as I say, one of the great illustrations of it was in the brainwashing thing that took place in Korea. But even in the church, it can lead to some very strange things. Turn back to Galatians. This is one of the classic examples of a huge problem that grew up in a church. And there are some interesting things about this that can be overlooked if you're not careful as to what the reason behind it was. Now, always, when you get together with a group of theologians, you're going to discuss the book of Galatians, and you start trying to figure out what exactly was the heresy in Galatia. And you can work your way through, circumcision was involved, and justification, and all of the doctrinal nuances and little technicalities of the problem in Galatia. They're all very interesting. But I think they are also absolutely irrelevant to what was really going on. Because the what in Galatia was not nearly as important as the why, and Paul knew it. But he addressed the doctrine. There was no question but what he had to do that. But he also made, I think, a very interesting statement in chapter 4, in verse 17. He said, they, that is, these people who are holding to the opposite point of view and making the accusations that they are making and advancing the doctrinal questions that they are advancing, they zealously affect you, but not well. Yea, they would exclude you that you might affect them. You realize what they're saying? He's saying they zealously impact you, but not for good. Yea, they would exclude you that you might impact them. The question was impact. It was the influence. It was being able to reach out and shake somebody and say, hey, I'm here, I'm important, and I can change something. I can actually make people look at me and say, you exist. What Paul is trying to tell the Galatians in this simple little verse is that what's going on here has nothing to do with the doctrine. It has to do with people and people's desire for preeminence, people's desire to be looked at and admired, people's desire to be of influence, people's desire to be a mover and a shaker of things, people's desires to have a cause in the cause-effect sequence. It's a very human thing that's going on. And it is very rare that the doctrine or the technicality of theology really has that much import in the whole thing going on. Why was the Galatian church divided? Because of a sincere difference of opinion? Oh my, no. We can enjoy a sincere difference of opinion. We can sit down with a cup of coffee and put our feet up and talk for hours about a sincere difference of opinion. We can look at the other guy's point of view. We can advance our own. We can argue with him about it. We can advance discussions. We can pick his thing apart. We can say, well, now, friend, I think you're wrong here. One thing you've overlooked. We can have a lot of fun with that. Now, a sincere difference of opinion doesn't do that. Why was the Galatian church divided? Was it because someone had to fulfill his need to impact and grasp at whatever came to hand? Later on in the book, in chapter 6, verse 12, he says, as many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they constrain you to be circumcised, only lest they should suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. For neither themselves who are circumcised are keeping the law. What's he saying? He's saying they're not sincere. This is not a sincere difference of opinion. This is not just a sincere advancement of a heartfelt and heart-believed doctrine. He said, they desire to have you circumcised that they may glory in your flesh. It's ego. It's self. It's the desire to have influence and control and to be able to be a mover and a shaker in this little society of ours that we have here. Paul also reveals, I think, that there is a positive and a negative impact you can have, because he said it is good to be zealously impacted, or to be zealous and having an impact in a good thing. In other words, this desire to change things is not bad. Oh, it's not bad at all. You know, as I said before, the problem that exists in the church, from church politics and all of the headaches and aggravations and divisions and splits, grows out of a very real and good human need. Something that God Almighty put down in us himself, the desire to be a cause in the cause-effect sequence. It is when you and I pervert that need and that desire is when it becomes a problem. Because it is good to be to zealously want to have an impact in a good thing. And there's no shortage of good things that can be changed, of good causes and good effects, or good effects that can be brought about by people putting their hearts and their heads to work in those good things. But strangely, we get off on other directions so much of the time. There is one little test, I think, that we need to continually apply to our zealous desires to be a cause in a cause-effect sequence, and that is, are you in the things that you are doing, or is the person that you're involved with, who is doing himself trying to be a mover and a shaker and an accomplisher of things, are you or are he attempting to control other people? Because almost always the results of attempts to control are going to wind up having a negative effect when the impact arrives. There are other familiar scriptures, I think, that are worth our taking a look at. 3 John, for example, where we're prone to turn lots of times and look at old Diotrephes, but we need to look at more than Diotrephes, because there's a lot said, frankly, in 3 John. Surprisingly, if you don't look first, I wonder how many of you can tell me to whom this letter was written. We know two names. We know John and Diotrephes, and we forget, I kind of wish in a way, this letter had been named the Epistle of John to Gaius. So we'd have Gaius' name in here. We could actually all look at Gaius, because he's really a man to be respected because of the way in which John writes to him. The elder under the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Beloved, I wish above all things that you may prosper and be in health, even as your soul prospers. For I rejoiced greatly when the brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, even as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do to the brethren and to strangers. Now here was a man who was zealous in a good thing. He was very diligent in trying to take care of strangers and look after the needs of people who came by. He was a hospitable type of a person. And he says, you do faithfully the things you do to the brethren. Your motivation is good. Your desire is for them and to help them, as opposed to an alternate that he's going to show. These strangers and brethren have borne witness of your love before the church, whom if you bring forward on their journey after a godly sort, you shall do well, because for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles. And he says, you know, it seems to be very, very important that those who go through these lands and do the work they do don't take anything of the people as they go. And it's so critical that the man of God and the person who's trying to serve, that it's clear to everybody, I'm not doing this for myself. And man, you talk about hard to make it work. Because apart from money and apart from taking anything like that, let's go on to see what else it is that one can take for oneself. We therefore ought to receive people like this, that we could be fellow helpers to the truth. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, will not receive us. Wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith. He doesn't just talking against us doesn't do it. Now, what in the world is this man doing? Here's John, the ancient, old John, the beloved apostle of Jesus Christ, who spent all that time in the ministry with Jesus Christ, who year after year after year has gone through sacrifice, has been a poor man, has himself served God's people at great sacrifice. What in the world are you supposed to say against that man? And what was Diotrephes supposed to accomplish in his ministry by running down the Apostle John? What indeed can any of us hope to accomplish in any ministry by running down somebody else? There's no joy in that. There's no gain in that. Well, maybe I'm not right. Maybe there is a gain in it. It's a perverse sort of a gain, but all it is a gain for your own ego. Because the only reason Diotrephes was putting down John was because John was a threat to his own power and his own control and his own ability to direct the affairs of the church in his area. John was an impediment to his own power, to his own desire to be an impactor. John diminished his impact, and he had to do something to get rid of John. And so, politic. How do we politic? We run somebody down. That's what the whole thing is all about. Neither does he himself receive the brethren, and he forbids them that would and casts them out of the church. What a tragic thing. You know, here are people who actually would be very happy to have a traveling evangelist who is going down the road, you know, and hungry and thirsty, and have been preaching the gospel faithfully in city after city after city after city. But because he came from John, this man, if a person took one of these men into his home and fed him and gave him a night of sleep, could be put out of the church by Diotrephes for having done so. Hard to imagine, isn't it? No, it really isn't. Because too many of us have seen just this type of an attitude in the church in the 20th century. Politics hadn't gone away. It's still here. It was here there. People do the same things, and they do them for pretty much the same reasons throughout all generations of the church. Beloved, don't follow that which is evil, but that which is good. He that does good is of God, but he that does evil has never seen God. Now Demetrius, on the other hand, has a good report of all men and of the truth itself. Yea, and we also bear record, and you know our record is true. I have many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write to you, because I trust I shall shortly see you, and we shall speak face to face. Peace be to you. Our friends salute you. Greet the friends by name. Beautiful old man in his letter he writes, he has to do a very distasteful thing. He has to write into an area, and he has to identify two faithful men and say that a third man can no longer be considered really as faithful. He names Diotrephes and says this man is really, don't follow that which is evil, the evil things that this man is now doing. And he says the men that we approve are Gaius and Demetrius in this area. Basically tells Gaius, really, that the man to be respected and followed is Demetrius. It occasionally is necessary for those who are following God and doing God's work to identify for the brethren's sake those people who still are faithful and those who are trying to serve and those who are being selfless in their service of the brethren, as opposed to those who are doing what they're doing for reasons that seem unworthy along the line. It's very interesting also, frankly, as you read through Jude, because you see some similar types of things that begin to take place, and church politics begins to rear its ugly head. Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, brother of James, to those who are sanctified by God the Father and preserved in Jesus Christ and called, mercy unto you and peace and love be multiplied. Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write to you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith once delivered to the saints. For there are certain men crept in unawares who were before ordained to this condemnation. ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. And then comes this tragic comparison with what happened of old, how that Israel had to be punished, how the angels that kept not their first estate had to be punished, and talking about how this type of thing begins to rear its ugly head in the church. He then speaks of these filthy dreamers who defile the flesh and despise dominion and speak evil of dignities, how they even will speak, you know, rail at the Satan the devil when Michael the archangel would not do such a thing as that. He says, "Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Korah." Korah was a typical politician. It was another one of these things. Has God spoken only through Moses? Hasn't God spoken by us? You take too much upon you, Moses, and challenge the authority or responsibility or the office of someone else. Why? Well, Moses was just a man. Moses could make mistakes. Sure, he could. But what were they after? Power. The diminution of Moses' power. The addition of their own. To fulfill that deep human need they had to be a mover and a shaker, a changer of the course of history and of events. All of it goes on and on and on. You know, it is really easy, and I can see how it can happen to people. On the one hand, you have people like Jude talked about who come into the church from the outside and cause trouble. Then you have the people that John talked about who from within the ministry of the church cause trouble. Sometimes it happens because it's easy to feel like a ghost in the house, even in the church. You get to the place to where you feel like nobody will listen to you. You know, I've got an idea, or I've got a thought, or I've advanced a doctrinal idea, and I sent a paper into headquarters, and I got disfellowshipped for my trouble, or I got ignored, or nobody would respond. And basically, some of them, I think, would rather be disfellowshipped, you know, or have somebody send back a letter and rail at them a little bit than just to ignore whatever it is they have to say. Or they feel that they're unable to effect change. I think that was one of the things that created some of the problem we had in the Worldwide Church of God back in 1974, and that Great Rebellion, as we called it sometimes in those days, took place. One of the complaints was, you can't get anything changed. You can't get anything through. We're all blocked up. And whether it was true or not, an awful lot of men in the ministry perceived that they could not effect change. That frustration leads to hostility, leads sometimes to anger. And, of course, in some people, a long time before they ever quite get that far down the line, let's say to being anger or open rebellion or open resentment, go off looking for something else that can be well, the word that is commonly used for it is a hook. They want to find something, some little hook, some claim to fame, something that I've got that other people don't have, so that people will have to listen to me and they will have to say, "You were right." Boy, those are nice words. You know, you can't imagine how good that feels to have somebody say, "You know, you're right." It may even be better to say, "You were right and I was wrong." Oh, no, that really sounds good. You know, say, "Friend, I was wrong and you were right." How many times in your lifetime have you ever heard that? Seldom enough that it really feels good if it ever happens to come your way. You know, that I was wrong and you were right. So that's what sometimes people want. Now, they look for it in 100 ways. They look for it by saying, "Well, I know how to pronounce God's name correctly." And we've all got to see this the same way. And they really have found, feel like it. And it's not, this is not insincere. They believe they found something, and they're all excited about it. And they set out to try to change people's attitudes and hearts on this question. Or it may be, "Well, we've had the calendar wrong. And if we can just get the calendar right, this is going to happen and that's going to happen." There are a group of people this year who are keeping the feast on the 15th day of the 8th month. As it happens, you know, it's the way we look at it, they're observing the Feast of Tabernacles, the 15th day of the 8th month. And it suddenly dawned on me this morning when I thought about that, made me wonder, did Jeroboam himself, the original, actually set up a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, or did he change the calendar and the writer, from a Jewish perspective, say he set up a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month? An interesting question, isn't it? It would have been a lot easier to tell the people that the calendar was different than it would be to say that the festival was wrong and let's move the feast to the 15th day of the 8th month. But that's another question for another day along the way. It could be that, or it can be simple things like people, you know, we realize that churches have divided over where they're going to meet. Churches have actually split up over the physical location of where the church is actually going to meet. People have gotten into bad attitudes over a question of who's going to pass out songbooks at church. And, of course, the divisions and the problems and splits over doctrinal trivia I mean, the list of those will go on and on and on, and I won't bore you with it along the way. I've just concluded that the politicians, like the poor, will always be with us. And in fact, it would be a sad day indeed if they were not, when you think about it. Because all these politicians are is people who want to make something happen. That's all. They just want to make something happen. The sad thing is that too many of us, and I say the politicians, I'm talking to a whole bunch of them. I don't think any one of you should ever for a minute step aside and say, no, I'm not interested in church politics, or I've never engaged. To whatever extent you've ever tried to influence anybody else around here about anything, you have engaged in political activity. By itself, it's not too bad. But the problem is, sad thing, that too many of us have focused on being heard than on having something to say. And that, to me, is one of the great tragedies of the whole thing. I just want to be heard, rather than, first of all, being concerned with being sure you've got something to say. It's awfully easy to go out and dig a hole in the ground to prove that you exist. You can do that. Any of us can do that. But, you know, it's another thing to get down in that hole with some cement and with, a trowel and cement up the sides of this thing all the way around it and maybe make your arrange the internals and the way water flows in, the water flows out to it, put a lid on it, and actually arrange a sewage processing plant for your home and for your family. That's a different matter, isn't it? It's one thing to dig a hole to prove that you exist. It's another thing to make something out of that hole so that we can say your existing means something. And that's where I feel a lot of the difference comes in politics and political activities and influencing people and one another in the church. Is that too much of the time all we're trying to do is just prove that we exist rather than establishing the fact that our existence has some meaning and some quality and that there's something to go, something to happen that's going to be good. It's easy to burn down a barn to prove you exist. It's another thing to build a home for your family to prove that your existence has worth. And all these analogies hold just as true in the church as they do anywhere. If you want to have impact, if you want to be a cause in the cause-effect sequence, if you actually would like to change things, as it were, to be a bit of a mover and a shaker, well, get on with it. You know, let's all get on with it. But let's don't engage in cheap politics. Turn back, if you would, to James, the first chapter in conclusion. James chapter 1, to just some fundamental statements about it. Because there are things in the church that need to be changed. There are lonely people in the church that need to have somebody visit them and spend some time with them. There are people who are right now confused and hurt and disappointed because they've been out of work for a long time and they really, not only are they broke, but they are discouraged and they really are confused mentally about what to do next. And they need a brother to come spend a little time with them and begin to point them in the right direction. Not just give them some money, although that needs to be done too, but to actually take them in hand and begin to maybe even train them for some other activity or some other job or point them in the right direction or give them some ideas. There are all sorts of changes that need to be made in the lives of people. Now, they may not get you an awful lot of recognition from a whole lot of people, but they might get you a tremendous amount of gratitude from one person. If you can wreak a change or rearrange something in somebody's life to help them along the way. James chapter 1 and verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither a shadow of turning. Of his own will he begat us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. Those frustrations, though, that come along, and you think, well, I want to be heard. Well, don't get in a hurry to be heard. Be swift. Be in a hurry to hear. But don't get in such a big hurry to be heard until you have something that you're sure is worth saying. We're going to be a kind of first fruit of these preachers. Let's be slow to speak, slow to get mad or upset or frustrated. For the wrath or the anger of man or the frustration of people does not work the righteousness of God. If what you're doing because you've gotten mad or you've gotten hostile or you're upset with somebody or you're trying, you know, you're politicking around for those reasons, the wrath or the anger or the frustration of a man cannot work the righteousness of God. So lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness and receive with meekness the engrafted word which is able to save your souls. Be you doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholds himself and goes his way and straightway forgets what manner of man he was. But whoever looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues therein, he being not a forgetful hearer but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. What James is trying to tell us is that more trouble in the church comes from people talking than from people doing. From people actually getting out and trying to make something happen, from them building and driving in nails and putting two befores together, from them actually doing the things that God commands, carrying out the law, visiting the sick, helping out people, carrying out the instructions of Christ with your hands. That's not where we have our troubles in the church. We have our troubles in the church where people have got to have something to say, even when they don't have anything worth saying. If any man among you seems to be religious and bridles not his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is vain. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. Be a cause. In this cause-effect sequence, you can change the church.
If you would like more information on available tapes and materials, write to Christian Educational Ministries, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas, 75791.